Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is program 16 for September 12th, 2006. Conestoga is Oklahoma's largest literary science fiction and fantasy convention. This is the second podcast to be posted after Conestoga 10. I'm Chris Murley, your podcast host, and we bring you an interview with John K. Gibbons, who is a JPL ambassador. John is a software consultant for Planview, Inc., and a science fiction fan and author. He grew up in the excitement of the early manned space program and the exploration of the moon and solar system through Ranger, Surveyor, and Pioneer. Now, as an ambassador, he looks forward to sharing the latest discoveries and the thrill of that ongoing adventure with communities around Central Texas. John has been a guest at Conestoga for the last 2 years, and his presentations about JPL missions in the solar system are always well attended. I had the opportunity to sit down with him at Conestoga 10. Our conversations covered the entire width of the solar system, from the planet Mercury to the formerly known as a planet Pluto, and a few places in between. Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Chris Merle, your podcast host, and today I have John Gibbons. He is a JPL ambassador, and I want to welcome him. Thank you.
Hello. Glad to be here.
Well, John, I know by your day job as a software analyst, but you are now a JPL ambassador. Can you tell us a little bit about that program and how you got involved in it?
Well, the Solar System Ambassadors program evolved out of an outreach program originally for the specifically for the Jupiter Galileo mission, and eventually it was extended to all of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory missions and even some other missions. In fact, the two missions that I'm talking about here at Conestoga are both managed by Johns Hopkins University's APL rather than by JPL, but they work together on the kind of outreach program. And basically, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory has been traditionally the lead laboratory among NASA for the deep space robotic missions, and they are providing some support, including the radio monitoring for even these two JH University missions that I'm talking about today. JPL looked for some way of reaching a wider audience, and they recruited through the web for people to sign up and help them. So I'm one of the volunteers. They now have volunteers from all across the country. I'm not sure. I think it's several hundred people currently. And you commit to finding your own venues for making presentations, and JPL provides training sessions. They provide slides and materials, some show-and-tell things occasionally, literature to hand out. And part of the training sessions involves a chance to ask some questions directly of the mission scientists.
Well, thank you. What attracted you to the to becoming an ambassador? What is your interest in the space program?
Well, I've been a fan of the space exploration since I was a kid. Grew up during the original days, the early astronaut exploration days. I remember running back and forth from the radio inside the school to tell kids outside during Alan Shepard's mission, and following the robotic missions with almost equal excitement, the first missions to the moon, the Ranger program, and so on, and later on the Mariner missions, which is the last time we've been to Mercury. It's been 30 years since we've had a spacecraft to Mercury. So I was fascinated by all of that. And a lot of science fiction fans have been very interested in the space program as well. So it seemed like a natural way to be able to spread the word about the work that was going on, because there's a limited amount of publicity on a lot of these missions. And people forget that we've got five spacecraft on and around Mars right now. That's just the U.S. spacecraft, not even counting the European.
Well, we've got the ESA Mars Observer and, of course, the two rovers. And what are the others?
Global Surveyor, the Odyssey spacecraft, and then a new orbiter just arrived a few months ago.
And are there any others getting ready to launch, I think? Or?
Well, we're on a general schedule of launching about every 2 years as the orbit becomes feasible. So there are missions in short-term preparation, two large, one really large rover, much more capable than the two that are currently rolling around, and then longer-term exploration plans as well.
Well, I think our listeners can find a great deal of information about Mars, and I know that you mentioned just a second ago about a mission to Mercury. We haven't been in, 30 years?
30 years. The Mariner 10 is the only spacecraft that has done any close observation of Mercury, and the Messenger was launched nearly 2 years ago, August 3rd on 2004. Amazingly, it's taking it 6.5 years to reach Mercury. Not that it's that difficult to reach Mercury, but this time the spacecraft is going to go into orbit around Mercury, so it's very difficult. It's kind of a cosmic billiards game, bouncing around with close flybys of the Earth last year, twice of Venus, and three times of Mercury as it adjusts its orbit closer and closer so that it can actually then, with a relatively small velocity change, take an orbit around Mercury in March of 2011.
That's when it's finally going to reach there.
Right.
When's its first passage of Mercury going to be?
January of 2008.
January 2008. One thing I have been reading about the Mercury Messenger is, of course, the heat shielding that they have to develop.
Very important.
How close will the Messenger get to the Sun? Is it going to get too much inside the Mercury orbit, or is it going to be not too much?
Very little closer than the Mercury orbit. That's pretty much, I don't have the exact figures, I'm not certain, but I think it may, it never gets significantly closer than Mercury itself.
Okay. I was just curious, I know that, you know, they're using the planets to break, you know, to lower it into orbit and then eventually get itself around Mercury.
Right.
And of course, unlike some of the Mars orbiters, it doesn't have any opportunity to do any kind of aerobraking, does it?
Correct. Mercury has a tiny volatile budget, so to speak. It's got, they don't call it an atmosphere, it has an exosphere. The molecules are so far apart that they tend to be flying around more or less freely rather than bouncing off of each other. There's not truly a pressure.
In 2011, we're going to have the Mercury Messenger. Now, that's when it's finally going to settle into its orbit and start exploring the planet.
Right.
Now, we're going to go to the other end of the solar system and just launch this year what was New Horizons, which is going to do a flyby of Pluto.
Exactly.
That's supposed to get there in 2014, I believe.
Is that 2015,
2015,
I think, if I wrote it down correct. The mission there is, it's a race against time. Also a race against politics to get it launched in the first place. This was a mission that the administration tried to cancel several times, and Congress restored the budget for it. And the reason it's a race against time was to the goal is to get there before the atmosphere freezes out, because Pluto has a very elliptical orbit, more so than any of the other planets. A few years ago, it was actually not the furthest planet. It was closer to the Sun than Neptune, and it is now getting further and further away. If the mission had been delayed very much, it would have cooled off so much that the atmosphere would have largely frozen out. And one of the goals is, in the flyby, to get a lot more detail about the atmosphere.
Do they know how close they're going to attempt to get to Pluto for that?
You know, I don't recall the details on that. It's I think within 1,000 miles, but I don't recall the
that is some figure. Fancy shooting.
Yes.
Because I know how hard it is, you know, for the original Voyager ones. I mean, the accuracy on that and going out that much further is just an amazing feat of engineering to get to hit something, to get that close to something that far away.
Right.
And when it does reach Pluto, do you know how many hours it's going to take for the signal to reach back to us?
I think it's about 4 hours, if I recall correctly.
4 hours. I mean, that's how, folks, that's how big our solar system is, that it takes 4 hours for a signal to get back to Earth. Are they going to have to beep up the – do you know if they're going to have to beef up the deep space network to receive the signal, or does it have – you know if it's going to have a fairly powerful transmitter?
Well, it has to – be, a lot of the data has to be held because it has to have a relatively low speed at that distance, better than Galileo. I mean, if you recall, the Galileo mission was essentially crippled because the main antenna never fully expanded, so they were limited to the low-gain antenna rather than the main antenna. So the New Horizons mission will be doing better than that, but it'll still be a relatively low bit rate, which means that it depends on having a lot of the information recorded. Now, the encounter is just a few hours in terms of the closest approach. Within a month or so, it's going to be getting better pictures than we've ever had before of Pluto. So it'll be better than the Hubble still a month away. So it'll have thousands of high-quality pictures compared to anything we've
so
ever
we'll
had before.
So we'll be able to learn quite a bit about it then. Well, that's excellent. The of course, you know, there's been a lot of the Kuiper Belt objects that have been recently discovered. They even discovered one, which I cannot think of the technical name, 2003 UB313 or something like that, which is, I think, nicknamed Xena right now.
Right.
But it was discovered to be larger than Pluto. I know that one of the things I was reading about New Horizons was that they're planning on trying to get measurements of some of the other Kuiper Belt objects. Is that correct?
The hope is that it will be possible to maneuver it towards one of the Kuiper Belt objects after going past Pluto and Charon. And there, by the way, there are two other moons of Pluto that have been discovered more recently, very small. And I don't know that they finalized that. Part of it is that they don't have the funding. That'll be in the extended mission category, so they'll have to get approval for the continued funding for that, but they do hope to do that.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to New Horizons getting close. Also, do you want to throw your two cents on whether Pluto should still be a planet, or do you think that they should expand the definition of a planet?
Well, I think that historically there's reason just for that reason, the historical tradition of calling it a planet. Honestly, if you look at the what we now know, it's hard to qualify it and rule out some of these others. And by the way, when you're talking about some of these others being larger than Pluto, there's a lot of inference in there because we don't have exact size measurements on any of these other objects. It's largely based on how bright they are and assumptions about the surface that would tell us how large it is to appear that bright. So there's been some recent revisions to those as they started to get something that gave an actual measure of the size, and I think that reduced its size, indicated it was probably still larger than Pluto, but just barely.
Well, I think it's amazing that they can do that kind of science to even detect those objects. And I suspect that, and you may agree, that they're going to find a lot more of those out there, you know, over the coming decades.
Right. It's almost certain that there are objects out there larger than Pluto, probably significantly larger.
Well, I know some of them say that the debate is, well, for historical reasons, we'll make Pluto a planet. Even if we find larger ones, then we're not going to call them planets for historical reasons. But one definition I heard was suggesting that if it's spherical, it's a planet. If it's not, then it's an object. But you know, it's because there's such a spectrum of sizes that it's really hard to pin a definition on what an object is, whether it's a star or a brown dwarf or a giant planet, or if it's a moon or a planet, or, you know, what, depending on its size. And there's just a whole spectrum. You can't really concretely say, yeah, that's that.
Quite true. But there actually are a few of the larger asteroids that would qualify as planets under that definition. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say.
I think the man in the street probably doesn't really care. He's still going to call Pluto a planet. But perhaps they'll have that decided by the time New Horizons arrives. I guess they'll maintain the argument that it is a planet so that they can continue getting funding for the mission. Well, it's not a planet. We shouldn't go.
Right. Oh, one other thing about its the trajectory, just a little detail that I think is fascinating. You know, despite the fact it's taking over 9 years to reach Pluto, the velocity at the beginning was so fast, the fastest of any spacecraft departing Earth, it reached the distance of the moon in 9 hours.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's a fast. And it's going to be, has it reached Jupiter yet, or is it?
No, the Jupiter encounter is in February of next year.
February next year. So it's fairly close.
Right.
And is it going to do any other gravity assists, or is it just Jupiter?
That's all. That was really the key to the mission. If it had been delayed by even a couple of weeks, it would have I'm not sure exactly what the breakpoint was, but very much of a delay, and it would not have been able to utilize the Jupiter gravity assist, which would have added quite a few years to the total mission.
Yeah, I understand it would have been something like 2019 or...
Right.
The solar system is huge, folks, and it's mind-bogglingly how large our solar system is, considering how many hours it takes for a signal to even, you know, the light to reach us from those planets.
To quote Douglas Adams, space is big, really, really big.
Yes, indeed. I guess you're not an ambassador to a particular planet. You're more of an ambassador at large.
Right.
You have a curious little object there in a little box, and hopefully I can find a camera to take a picture of it. Otherwise, I will link to pictures on when I do the show notes to what this little object is. And for you Star Trek fans out there, the name Genesis may have a different meaning to you than to people that aren't familiar with it. And they may have heard of Genesis and the unfortunate little spill that it took in the Utah desert. but what is that little object you have there?
I have a bit of aerogel. And it's also called solid smoke sometimes. Now, actually, this relates to the Stardust mission, and the two missions make a great story together.
Before continuing our conversation about Genesis and the Stardust missions, a few words about Pluto and New Horizons. Since this podcast was recorded, the International Astronomical Union, the IAU, decided that Pluto is no longer a planet. On August 26, 2006, in Prague of the Czech Republic, the IA General Assembly voted Pluto out of the August bodies we know as planets. The original proposal would have included the asteroids Ceres, Pluto, Charon, and 2003 UB313, aka Xena, as planets. As there are possibly hundreds of Pluto-sized objects in the deep outer solar system, the new definition didn't sit well with some IAU members. The astronomer Mike Brown, whose discovery of Xena led to the crises defining what a planet is, didn't feel that Pluto or Xena qualified as a planet either. These objects are now called dwarf planets. Only a few hundred IAU members out of the 10,000-member body voted on this new definition. A fair number of astronomers and the public still want Pluto to be called a planet. Perhaps by the time New Horizons arrives in 2015, the issue will be settled. I checked the satellite count for Jupiter and Saturn, and they have 63 and 56 known satellites, respectively. Well, if they can have that many moons, why should the Sun be limited to a paltry 8 planets? No doubt astronomers will discover more Pluto and UB313-sized objects over the coming decades, and the new definition will probably stand until they find an Earth or Mars-sized object in the deep recesses of the outer solar system. When I asked John how close New Horizons was going to get to Pluto for its flyby, he said around 1,000 miles. After recording our podcast, he went and checked to make sure. He corrected himself and told me New Horizons' closest approach is going to be 10,000 kilometers. That's still some mighty fancy shooting. As he pointed out, when the probe is about a month away, we will start receiving images better than any that have ever been taken from Earthbound observatories and the Hubble Space Telescope. When I asked him how long the signal from New Horizons would take to reach us, he said around 4 hours. I checked, and we'll have to give a minor correction. Actually, it's going to take almost 5.5 hours to reach us. Whether it takes 4, 5, or 6 hours, that's still a long, long way. To put that in context, the signal from the furthest man-made object in the solar system, Voyager 1, currently takes 12 hours to reach us. And now, onto Genesis and Stardust.
Alexis Glenn Latner and I did a panel a few years ago here at Conestoga, and in Austin, we similarly did a panel at the Armadillicon convention that I have been involved with a lot there, called Frost and Fire, talking about the Stardust mission, gathering information about the solar wind. Excuse me, I got it backwards. The Stardust mission was gathering information about comets. That's the one that was using the aerogel as a collector medium to get the dust particles from the vicinity of a comet. And the Genesis mission is the one that took a nosedive into the Utah desert. And it had a very similar mission profile. These were the first two sample return missions in I believe since the Apollo lunar missions, and both of them were gathering information about the extremes of the solar system, just like the New Horizons and MESSENGER. But they're waiting for the material to be brought to us. In a sense, comets are bringing us samples of the original material, the debris left over from the formation of the solar system, which has been kept in a deep freeze out in far distant space. But occasionally, as these pieces rattle around, one of them will get stuck on an orbit that drops it deep into the gravity well. And as it comes close, the volatiles boil away and take off dust particles that are captured with all that snow and ice. And the idea was that the stardust lifted out a panel that held a bunch of pieces of this aerogel, and the tiny particles of dust would strike that aerogel and be slowed down and captured within these pieces, which protected them, it slowed them down so they didn't just vaporize on impact. And it made them easy to find because you could see the trail that they left going through the aerogel. The Genesis stayed on orbit just kind of they called it a halo orbit, orbiting around, I believe, L1. I can't remember.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
That's the Earth-Sun Lagrange point, not the Earth-Moon Lagrange point, because you've got to define which two bodies you're talking about when you mention these. So it's the neutral point. Approximately 1 million miles away from the Earth in the direction of the Sun, and it held out these panels which were wafers of very, very pure material, much like the wafers that are used in creating semiconductors like microprocessors and memory and so on. The idea being that these were so extremely pure that you could identify atoms that weren't supposed to be there. So you were picking up the individual atoms that were blown into this by the solar wind, and they would, similarly as the dust particles would be captured and identified inside the aerogel for the stardust, you'd find these solar wind particles deep inside the silicon or diamond wafers, some sapphire, a number of exotic materials were used in those wafers.
Now, that piece of aerogel you have there, is that actually from the stardust, or is that just a sample?
No, this is just a sample.
May I see it? I have never actually seen any aerogel up close.
Just don't touch it.
It doesn't
really harm it, but it's rather fragile.
I'm a bad host. I'm sorry.
Well, I did open it up so you could
I'll take a close look here. And
it's hard to even see it without opening up the package. It's amazingly.
Oh my goodness!
It really does seem like frozen smoke.
I mean, it obviously has almost no weight whatsoever to it. This is just amazing stuff. Are there places that you can purchase this?
There probably are, but it's probably rather expensive. This is actually a scrap of the material that was cut off as they were preparing some aerogel for one of the Mars rover, I think the new Mars rover mission. That's a very different use of it. They're actually using it for its insulation and structural properties.
Wow. Well, thank you for showing it to me, and I apologize for touching it when I was supposed to.
That's fine.
But it's just like kind of, well.
It's hard to resist touching it because you can't tell where the surface is almost from looking at it.
I suppose if people watch Star Trek, they see them bumping into a force field. That's kind of what it's like. It's like there's something there, but it's resisting me. Obviously, we have to make references to our favorite shows because otherwise we may not have a point of reference.
One other thing I'll say about it is it appears different when you're looking through it at a white object versus a dark object. When you're looking through it at a light surface, you see a slightly gray-brown appearance. But when you're looking at a dark surface beyond it, you're getting more diffuse light coming in from the side and being diffused, and it looks a bluish tint.
Well, let's go ahead and explain a couple of things. I know I can post links to Wikipedia, which is a great resource to tell you all about aerogel and Lagrangian points. But I believe aerogel is what is it? Silicon and
It's silicon. So it's like glass, except that it's mostly air.
And what is it, like 99% air or something?
Pretty much.
Yeah, so it's amazing that that kind of that fragile structure can be, you know, still a solid and yet mostly air. So I seem to recall seeing. I guess if you could you are is the air sealed within or is it porous?
It's pretty well sealed inside.
So if, for example, if you could like form the aerogel in say like a helium environment, it might float.
I'm not certain exactly what the process is. I presume that would probably be possible. In fact, this is not one of the lowest density pieces. Mm-hmm. I took this to a lab at Shriner University in Kerrville, mm-hmm. close to where I live, to measure this piece. And this piece weighs about a gram, which is fairly dense compared to air.
Yeah, there are hummingbirds that weigh less than that.
Quite a bit. Yeah, I was thinking if I did the calculations right that if some of the lowest density pieces you could put in a glass jar, and if you raise the pressure to a couple of atmospheres, I think it really would float. Just the standard, you know, without even making it an aerogel, just because it's got such mm-hmm. a low proportion of silicon in some of the extreme mm-hmm. low-density pieces.
Yeah, and I made a mistake earlier because the aerogel was used in Stardust to capture the particles, and Genesis, which crashed in the Utah desert, used wafers of pure material to capture the particles from the sun.
Right.
From what I understand, Stardust had some interesting surprises there Stardust on one side it captured what kind of particles did it capture?
There's an interstellar dust stream mm-hmm. That was detected by some previous missions. I forget just which one, but the discovery was made some time ago that there's a wind of dust particles blowing through the solar system. The solar wind is blowing away the interstellar gases, but the dust particles can move through the solar wind. So the decision was made that the Stardust could get samples of both this and the comet. Now, it was on a fairly long orbit that went out past the orbit of Mars, so that as it swung back in, really from the edges of the asteroid belt, it would come at a tangent to the path of the comet Vilt 2. It also got some very good pictures close up of the comet, and so we now know that there's quite a bit of variation in what the nucleus of comets look like from the three that have been observed fairly close now. But it unfolded its panels to receive the comet dust on one side. At the other end of its orbit, when it was in a nice position to interact with the interstellar dust that was streaming by, it unfolded its collection panels so that the dust would be striking the opposite side from where the comet dust was later captured. So it was very easy to tell them apart because they leave the trail in the aerogel as they impact. So it's easy to tell which ones are the cometary dust versus the interstellar dust.
Thank you. Okay, let's see here. I'm going to go ahead and pause for just a second here. We just took a short break here to kind of catch our breath, and we went from one end of the solar system to the other, and then we talked about some sample return missions, and now we're going to talk about the planet, I think, that is probably features largest in everyone's imagination, especially a science fiction fan, is the planet Mars. And John here has talked a great deal on the Mars rover missions. And what are some of the biggest surprises of the Mars rover missions that you could tell us about?
Well, one of the major objectives of the Mars rovers was to identify the role of water in the geological history of Mars. Perhaps I should say the aerological history of Mars. But in fact, that is largely why the particular sites were chosen from based on prior observation, there were some indications of the possible past presence of Mars of water in these particular areas on Mars. The presence of hematite in Meridiani Planum and in Gustav Crater, where the other rover landed, there were indications of what looked like sedimentary material just from looking at the photographs from orbit. And in fact, both of these turned out pretty positive. It took a while to determine that in Gustav, but in Meridianum, if you recall, it was a hole-in-one phenomena that the rover actually landed in a small crater that meant that there was exposed rock right there. And several of the indications of water in the formation of those materials were established very early in the mission, pretty conclusively. Now, this indicated that there was water present in the history of those rocks, not necessarily that they formed in the conventional matter of sedimentary rocks at the bottom of an ocean. There's a lot of indication that there may have been some shallow water with some stream or wave action. There's a cross-bedding effect that shows up in the patterns of the rocks. And a lot of chemical indications that suggest the idea that you had a shallow body of very mineral-rich water that evaporated away. So it's not sediment settling out so much as the evaporation process that led to some of these rocks being deposited.
Do they know how long ago this was to have taken place?
I don't think that that's been settled very conclusively yet, but the expectation is that it's probably quite some time in the past, probably billions of years.
The one thing that's amazed me about the Mars rovers is how they just keep going and going like the Energizer Bunny.
Oh, yes, amazing. Way past their warranty date.
And, of course, to me, the most surprising thing was is how they were worried about the dust getting on the solar panels, and then they discovered that just by pure accident they had dust devils clearing them off.
Yes. In fact, I believe that the previous mini rover and my mind is blanking on the name of that mission, but there was the first mission that landed with the bubble protection and had a small rover that did not have its own independent radio relay, but sent some information back to it. Now that had pressure sensors and wind sensors and detected a dust devil traveling right over that spacecraft, which was one of the interesting bits of evidence early on. But they really were, as you say, quite surprised at what an amazing job that did of cleaning the dust off of the solar panels of these spacecraft.
Well, I guess they don't have to put windshield wipers or dust wipers on the next ones. You know, the airbags was an amazing feat of technology, you know, an amazing achievement to allow them to drop. I just want to make a little aside. This is a personal thing. There's a movie called Red Planet, a really bad Mars movie with Val Kilmer, and the escape pod. They, because of the first Mars mission, where they used the airbags, they surrounded their escape pod in these airbags so it could bounce across the surface of Mars when it crash landed. And I was reading about the Mars rovers, and that is the very close to the maximum physical size that they could actually use airbags. So, folks, you can't build a human capsule and use airbags.
Right. It doesn't scale up very well. It's great for that size, but it I think that the next rovers will not be able to use that for the reasons you mentioned.
Yeah, I also believe there's going to be another Mars Polar Lander that's on its way.
That's the plan, yes.
And I think it's going to land more in the conventional way that the because I think it may be at a higher altitude than the Mars rovers, if I'm correct. I could be wrong, but that or the atmosphere is going to be thinner, and so they're going to have to use rockets like they did for the Viking landers.
There, I think there are a couple of issues in that design. I can't remember all of the details, but part of it is the size, and part of it the atmospheric density closer to the poles, which is there are several factors going into that, but the elevation in that area certainly is one of them.
That'll be fairly exciting. I believe, is that one going to be solar-powered, or are they using radioisotopes for that?
My recollection is solar-powered. There may be some small radiothermal elements just to keep the electronics warm at night. They're doing that even on the current rovers for a very limited degree.
I wasn't aware
of that. It's not a power source.
Oh, it's just kind of like a hand warmer.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess for all the writers out there that trying to keep up with what we're learning about Mars, that they're just going to have to keep changing what they write. I think a lot of writers, you know, if they don't know something about it, they can make up what they want to work for their story. whereas the bread and butter scientists, you know, they're going like, yep, you can't write about that. But anyway, that's enough commentary on that.
Just one comment. A couple of years ago, one of the pleasures of this volunteer program, I did several presentations for school kids about the Mars rovers in particular. Mm-hmm. And you get questions about, how do we bring them back afterwards? you can't help personalizing it. You can appreciate the feelings of kids that it's mm-hmm. a shame, you know, to leave these out there. And hopefully if travel to the planets does become practical on a larger scale, maybe one of these days, one of these early missions will be brought back and put in the Air and Space Museum. But that's not part of its mission, of course. I was thrilled, though, to receive a packet of thank you notes, including some drawings mm-hmm. that some elementary school kids had done. And one of them had an image of me standing in front of some slides, and the note on the slides, there might have been water on Mars. And mm-hmm. I was thrilled that they had gotten that key point out of the presentation. Very gratifying.
Well, talking about the water on Mars, before we do that, I just want to say I'm hoping in the future we'll have more and more manned space flights, and eventually, you know, we'll go to Mars and then we'll build museums around the first landers so that the, you know, future our descendants can go and visit, you know, visit our history there.
True.
Now, of course, you know, they discovered that there had been water action on Mars, but I guess one of the big mysteries is where did all the water go, or where is it? Did it escape into space, or is it locked up in the Martian crust someplace?
Well, the some of the instruments on board the Mars Odyssey spacecraft have established pretty firmly that there is a much larger amount of water bound up as ice under the surface. We knew there was some ice in the polar caps. But there's an amazing amount of ice under the surface, down to 30 or 40 degrees away from the pole.
Mm-hmm. I remember some of the pictures from ESA. They were talking about that there's like ice under some of the surface near the equator. Is that correct?
Some, yes. Not as high quantities as further mm-hmm. away, but yes.
And I suppose we should explain, and I'll ask you to explain to the listeners, why is water so important? Why do they want to find water on Mars, or why are they looking for or to not just the geological history of the planet, but what are some of the other reasons why, you know, to searching for water on Mars?
Well, for the long-term exploration of space by humans, the presence of water certainly would be a significantly enabling factor for us to be able to go there and set up a permanent colony. But from a scientific viewpoint, the critical point is the implications as far as life on Mars. If there was a wet environment, a warmer wet environment for a significant part of Mars's history, then it becomes much more plausible that life did come to exist on Mars as well as on Earth. And possibly if that were the case, there may be some extreme forms of life that still could exist as microorganisms beneath the surface.
Well, we're just only scratching the surface of Mars now, and hopefully we'll see many more missions to come to not just Mars but to all the planets, and certainly hopefully more people in space too. But I'm pretty happy with the robotic probes right now.
Gets lots of information. It's extremely productive.
Well, John, I want to thank you for taking the time, for allowing me to interview you, and you've been very informative and very educational.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I hope that you enjoyed hearing what John Gibbons had to tell us about New Horizons, Stardust, Genesis, Mercury Messenger, and the flotilla of Mars missions. If you are interested in astronomy podcasts, I'd highly recommend Slacker Astronomy and Planetary Radio. You can find links to these podcasts and the missions mentioned in our show notes. It's a little early to be saying looking forward to seeing you at Conestoga 11, so thanks for listening until our next Conestoga podcast. For more information, our web address is www.sftulsa.org or send an email to conestoga@sftulsa.org. Questions about our podcast may be sent to podcast@sftulsa.org.